for little risk. Send lawyers, guns, and money. Dad, get me out of this. Ha!
Welcome, everybody, to episode 74 of the Matt Jones podcast, the sixth one we've done since we restarted. And I think the first person I scheduled to do one of these when we restarted was Ryan McGee of ESPN. You've seen him on, you know, he writes about everything. He was NASCAR, college football, Marty and McGee. It's taken us a while to get connected because we both, we've been passing in the night, but it's good to have you here. How are you doing?
I'm good, yeah. So when this thing started, which I had just seen you, yes. I was in Lexington working on our Big Rex Chapman story. And then, like, literally 1 week later, right after I saw you is when everything shut down. I was on my truck on the way to the airport to go to Nashville for the SEC tournament. But when this thing started, we had this huge Rex Chapman piece. And that kept me really busy, like, the first 2 weeks of quarantine. And then I was like, man, I don't know what I'm going to do after that. And I have been so busy. I mean, as you know, every day I wake up and there's something else I got to write about or something else I got to do. And but I'll take busy over. But cleaning out the garage and working in the yard and all that stuff, as you can attest, I can't even make time for a podcast. So
I totally understand. You listen, yeah. You're a busy man.
Coming back. Yeah, all that stuff.
It stopped. Somebody's beeping. I'm hitting my girlfriend's apartment, and New York City is so different than everywhere else. And it's you have to buzz people in, and people just ring it all the time because her name is the first thing that comes up.
Right.
And it's like it's the most annoying thing in
the
world.
It's like the movies, right? It's like the mafia, or you don't answer it, right?
Exactly. Well, that's all the movies. That's exactly right.
Yeah. In all the movies, when they buzz, something bad's about to happen.
All right. So you do a lot of stuff. So you do NASCAR, college football. You mentioned the Rex piece, and I want to talk to you about that too. But I'm really kind of most interested in talking with you about the college football angle, at least to start, because everybody is wondering what's going to happen with college football. I was actually on – I've got something potentially I'm going to do this fall, and I was talking to some folks, and it was three or four different people, all of whom are kind of decision makers, and they all sort of agreed that they don't have any idea still yet what's going to happen with college football. And I think a large part of that is there is no decision maker in college football. It's not like the NBA where you can just get the players and the owners together and do it. It is now June 5th. Where do you see things for this fall for college football?
Well, I believe that there will be games played. I've never believed it would start on Labor Day weekend. I've thought that there's going to be some sort of delay built in. And I feel even more strongly about that now, after they open up all these athletic facilities, and it took almost an hour for us to hear about positive tests of athletes, not at one school or two schools or three schools, but a lot of schools. And that's only going to increase. And so I'm not a scientist, but I have erred on the side of caution personally with myself and my family about this whole thing. And it wouldn't have bothered me one bit if they had said, y'all can come back and work out and lift weights on August the 1st. Instead of June the 1st. It felt like I was in a little bit of a hurry. And I get that the athletes are already in town. I get that everybody wants to get on with it. But it just felt a little early for me. And so now I feel even more strongly that if it's going to start, and I think it will start, but I think it's maybe going to start a little bit later. And it's certainly, I think it's the smart thing to do. In the beginning, I think at best, it's going to be season ticket holders spread out throughout the stadium. You know, I don't see the sense in having 100,000 people in one place when this thing starts. And I'm not saying it won't be like that by the end of the year. But anyway, I'm confident there's going to be football. From minute one, I've been confident it's just not going to be like what we normally have week one, you know, 135 schools all playing games and a lot of those stadiums having, you know, 75,000 people in there. I don't think opening weekend, whenever it happens, is going to look like that.
It did feel to me like when the news came out yesterday about the five Alabama players, it did feel like to me that should be an eye opener. I mean, it's five people at the most high profile school. I mean, you know, things matter when they happen elsewhere, but in football, if it happens at Alabama, Ohio State, Notre Dame, et cetera, that matters more. In basketball, if it happens at Kentucky or Duke or North Carolina, it matters more. And I just think that matters more. But I also think that college football, and you tell me if you disagree, has a cultural view that is different than every other sport. So I think you could say that fans and media of the NBA, of football, of pro football, I don't know about so much about baseball, but the NBA and pro football lean liberal. And so they lean like wanting to do the quote unquote liberal thing. And college football is completely different. And it, especially in the SEC. And I think there's much more of a push amongst fans in college football to start than there is these other sports. Do you agree with that?
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, in New York or in California or any of these areas that are, have been much more measured with their phases and with their return to work. You know, they have so many options, but college football obviously is a big deal in the Southeast because it's the only professional sport that we have for the most part. And so I think that that has a lot to do with it. And you're also talking about, and I mean, with NASCAR returning so early, I've been very educated. You know me, I avoid politics. Unlike you, I avoid politics at all costs when the microphone's in front of me.
And but by the way, when I talk about this, I don't mean politics like Trump, Biden. I just mean like cultural
Absolutely.
You know.
Right. And where I'm going with that is that what I've learned with this NASCAR return is, you know, yes, they return to Darlington and to Bristol and going to Atlanta this weekend. They return to those tracks because of their proximity to Charlotte, where most of the race teams are. But it's also because those states are open. You know, it's the only reason they're going to Homestead, Miami, 900 miles away, you know, later in June, is because those are the states that they can do that. They could not, when this thing started, race in New Hampshire or at the California Speedway or Sonoma or even Phoenix or those. So I think that because of where the SEC is, because these are almost exclusively state-supported universities, I think it shouldn't be a surprise. And I'm not saying it's the wrong thing because I don't know the answer. We won't know the answer until we get to August, or really until we get to the middle of July. But it just feels early to me. If my gym is not going to let anyone go in there and lift weights for probably another 2 months, then I don't know. And you're right. If Alabama can't protect them, I'm not sure who can. And they're young. They're at peak physical condition. They're 22 years old. On paper, they should be okay. But that, you know, they're also – unless they're making them stay in their dorm or unless they're making them stay in that building and sleep on a cot, then whatever they get off of, you know, in the weight room is going to walk out the door at some point.
And that's, it's interesting you say that like that, because I agree with you. And also though, college football, I think has a more, I guess the sort of, I don't know, the pressure of the populace, of the population, is greater because, and again, let's just take the NBA. If Mark Cuban does or doesn't want to play, people in Dallas will care, but it's ultimately Mark Cuban's call. Right. But in college football, every university has a different power structure in terms of who's making the decisions. Right. Some of them it's the president, some of them it's the AD, some of them it's actually boosters. Yep. And so a lot of the forces that put pressure in college football are outside forces, their governors, their political forces. Like, I feel like that makes it even more complicated, doesn't it?
Super complicated. But what I've also said since minute one, and I've had coworkers argue with me about this, is all due respect to the coaches and the commissioners and the athletic directors and even the strength coaches that, you know, are talking about stuff with writers about all this, it's up to the university president. At the end of the day, that's where it begins and ends. And if the university president, who is much more concerned about his or her 60,000 undergrads and their $30,000 each worth of tuition, and if their parents are going to let them back on campus, and if it's safe to have the dorms open, that's their concern. All due respect to the 100 guys in the football building, in our world, the football team is the most important thing. And yeah, Texas, the athletic department has a $200 million budget. The university has a budget that dwarfs that. And so at the end of the day, if the school doesn't open the doors, then, you know, when USC says we're going to have classes that's a big deal, because that means that the football team can probably do what they're going to do. But if the, you know, father, whatever his name is now at Notre Dame, says, hey, no way we're having classes this fall, well, then guess what? That includes the football team. And yeah. So I've said all along, you know, at the end of the day, the NCAA is run by the presidents. That's it. And nobody likes to talk about that. Nobody understands that. But at the end of the day, the president's council makes the make. That's the buck stops there. And if they were to sit in that room and say, we're not going to play, which I don't think they will, but if they were to sit in that room and say, you know what, we're not open campuses this fall, then there won't be any football either.
And there's a lot of economic pressure on those presidents to have classes. Forget about
it. Mean, no. And I'm telling you, and this is coming from the son of a university president in Division II, but was on the NCAA President's Council. But my father's daily pie chart, athletics was this tiny slice of it. And even the president at the University of Alabama, athletics is a larger slice than it was for my father at a D2 school, but it's still not nearly as big as it is dealing with the fact that, you know, he has protesters on campus, or dealing with the fact that, you know, he's got a sexual a complaint filed against a professor, you know, in the agriculture campus. I mean, I'm just saying that there's a much larger thing he has to worry about, he or she has to worry about, than whether the football team is playing in the fall. And it's important, but it's on a list of important things.
Let's talk about fans for a second, because you would know the answer to this, I think, more than I would. Do you think decisions as to how many people will be in the stands will be made at the state level or the conference level? Because I think that maybe affects Kentucky as much as anybody for this reason. I think Kentucky's in a conference where the other states in the conference are a lot more open than Kentucky is. Whereas a lot of conferences, that's not the case. It is true here. Do you think they'll make one policy for the whole SEC, or will it be a state-by-state thing?
They will try to make one policy for the SEC. And I say try. I'm not saying they can pull it off. But the reason that the SEC has the SEC chant is because years ago, they were all pulled into a room by Mike Slive and said, quit arguing with each other and get on the same page. And they've been on the same page ever since. And, you know, this will be the ultimate test of that, because on paper, yes, they want to sit in a room or get on a Zoom call and make a group decision. But this thing comes down to what the state's doing, what the city's doing, what the county's doing. And it's like that in life, let alone athletics. And so, there will be an attempt to make a decision as a conference. And but you're talking about 14 schools spread out over almost that many states. And I'm going to be really impressed if they're all on the same page, because they all have to answer to exactly what you're talking about, is they have to answer to the governors and all that. And then as far as attendance goes, you know, their biggest concern is going to be taking care of those season ticket holders. And what I'm already hearing is, we have 18,000 season ticket holders. Hey, we can spread them out. You know, they're already starting. Mm-hmm. The topic of conversation is already about taking care of them first. So all due respect to Joe Sixpack, who, you know, gets his mini season ticket package and goes to three home games at you know, whatever stadium in the SEC. Once again, you're going to be last in line about concern, because they're going to be much more worried about, you know, the guy that owns the oil company that happens to be on the board of trustees.
Yes. Yeah. So let's say, all right, so at Kentucky, they have just under 30,000 season ticket holders.
Right.
And the stadium holds a little over 60,000. So it's about half.
Right.
I there are two things that are funny to me. One, does that mean they're going to say, all right, well, then our capacity is half, because that's how many season ticket holders they have.
Yeah.
And then two, if you spread everybody out and you're going to have to give some people that are used to really good seats, seats. Not everybody's going to get to sit where they are. How do you think that works? It won't be as big a deal at Kentucky, but there's some schools where that'll be fighting words.
It won't be any different than if you and I were going to see the Atlanta Braves this weekend, and we have the big fancy ticket that lets us go to the club behind home plate, and we're walled in and the peasants can't get in to see us. We are a much higher priority to the good people there at the ballpark than the guy who has season tickets but is in section 235, row Z. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, that's how it's going to be. The haves will have, and the have-nots, even if they have season tickets, will have not. And that's just there's going to be a pecking order to that.
All right. So what have you heard about the talk? And this is, I think, the thing that has to be considered before you start, which is, what if a player not only gets it, but gets really sick? What happens then?
I don't know. It's funny. We mentioned NASCAR. I mean, as we speak, I'm waiting on an editor to post a column I wrote about NASCAR had this kind of crazy return, 7 events in 11 days, and they had a week off, and now they're about to start another run of that. And that's the conversation that I had with the NASCAR officials, which was, so I was at Darlington Raceway in the rain for their second race back, and a NASCAR official came by in a golf cart, was nice enough to check in on me as I stood in the rain doing Sports Center. And what he said to me was, he said, we've never been worried about these first two races back. We're worried about 14 days from now. And so that's the scenario that you're talking about that keeps everybody awake, which is, you know, if this was last year and Tua Tagovailoa showed up and have a positive COVID-19 test, and now they got to go back and contact trace him, everybody that he lives with, everybody that he eats with, everybody that he's worked out with, now they got to test all those guys, and, you know, a half a dozen of them come up positive, and meanwhile, he's in the hospital on a respirator. No, that's worst case scenario. That's a shutdown scenario. And what I've tried to tell NASCAR fans first, and now I will try to tell NBA fans, and I will try to tell, you know, maybe, who knows, maybe one day baseball will come back, baseball fans, college football fans, NFL fans, if that happens, everyone needs to understand they will shut it down. Or they had better shut it down. And in NASCAR's case, I know there's a doomsday shut it down scenario that's on paper. And everyone else is going to have one of those too, because you're exactly right. Because now, going back to what we said earlier, that's the 21-year-old kid who is in the best shape of any human being on the planet. And if he's in the hospital really sick, then –
That's not a hard sermon to write right there.
Everybody,
but isn't that going to happen? I mean, I feel like,
yeah. No,
like it, when you consider the fact that there's 135 colleges,
right,
it's going to happen.
Yeah.
So, like, on some level, doesn't college football just have to decide we're willing to take that? Because it's going to happen at one of these schools. Yep. It just is.
I know. But and the hope is that the really smart people who make the decisions, and some not so smart people who make the decisions, the hope is that they've sat in a room and they've said, all right, here's the flow chart. This is what's going to happen in all these scenarios. And that's why the June 1st thing bothers me on a lot of levels, because it just feels rushed. And maybe it's not. Maybe I'm wrong. I'm not into meetings. But it just feels like, why not wait 4 more weeks? Or, you know, 5 weeks and coming after July 4th, just to give yourself a chance.
But you know the answer to that, right?
I do.
And the answer, yeah. The answer is the pressure from, I think, this is at least my take from the fans.
Yep.
And I'll give you an example why. So I heard after the athletic directors had a meeting like 3 or 4 weeks ago that Fulmer was the one person who sort of stood up. And apparently there were a couple other people that agreed with him. But Fulmer was the person who stood up in the meeting and was like, I think we're going fast. Let's take it 2 weeks, 4 weeks later. And it was clear that he was the main person thinking that. A lot of the other folks didn't. And I put that out. And by the way, I said on my radio show, I agree with Fulmer. I'm not a Tennessee guy. I usually make fun of Tennessee, but I actually agree with Fulmer. But when I put that out, Tennessee fans were furious at me for the idea that their guy wouldn't want football back. They were like, that's not what Fulmer wants him to play. And it was clear that what I thought was just normal news, and actually in some ways commendable by Fulmer, it made people angry that Fulmer would have that position. Isn't that what drives this quickness?
Yeah, and it's just – it's the mistake of emotional attachment. And listen, we all love it. I mean, I'm sitting in my office talking to you right now, and I am surrounded by sports memorabilia that I have collected since the day I was born, whether I was getting paid to go to games or not, you know, because I love it. But, you know, it sucks being stuck in the house, and it sucks not being able to watch your games or go to your favorite bar or, you know, go to your favorite pizza joint or take your kids to the movies. It's all awful. But you can't allow yourself to be emotionally attached to that, and that includes football. This is science, and it's a science that with this virus that we're not 100% sure even what it does and doesn't do yet. They're still learning about it every day. And so what you're talking about is an emotional attachment to Tennessee football, which I've had since I was 18 years old, and I get it. No one's more passionate about it than I am. But that's passion isn't what this is about. And manning up is not what this is about. And being American is not what this is about. It's about just doing the right thing. And so you can't be angry at someone, even if he's your former coach and he's your athletic director, for just putting it out there. Are we doing the right thing? That's just a conversation that takes place. And so you're not betraying your cause. You're just asking a question and putting out a scenario. And that's, I think that's the mistake that everyone makes about a lot of things, but particularly with this, which is this is not an, it shouldn't be an emotional thing other than just being depressed because I'm stuck in the house. It should be, what are the X's and O's of it? Let's worry about that. And then we'll sell. It's just like a football game. What's the game plan? And let's hope that it works. And then we can either celebrate or be sad, you know, when we see what the outcome is.
Since you mentioned you're a Tennessee guy, you know, man, there's no fan base that gets on me more than Tennessee.
Or maybe me. Sometimes. Same for me, by the way. I've got mainly because of what I've written about Fulmer over the years. I haven't made a lot of friends.
So I grew up on the Kentucky-Tennessee border. All my TV stations I got were Tennessee stations. So growing up, even though I was a Kentucky fan, I saw more Tennessee football stuff than any human being should have to watch,
right?
With all those TV stations there. And I want to talk about two things. First, let's talk about the passing of Johnny Majors. When I was a kid, I thought Johnny Majors was sort of what class should look like in terms of a person. Like, he wore the jacket and he looked like an old distinguished man to me when I was a kid. And I just, my first images of coaches in many ways was him, because he'd be on the news every night looking good, et cetera. He passed away. I know you were close to him. What talk about him for a second.
Well, I mean, I mentioned me being a student. When I was a sophomore at Tennessee, I was fortunate enough to get a job with the video crew, with the film crew for the football team. And so for 3 falls and 2 springs, I just got lucky. My assignment was I'd hauled my video camera and all my tapes up to the top floor of the orange and white tower that oversaw the offensive practice field. And that's where Coach Majors was every day. He climbed that same tower in the same spot. And so every practice, I mean, 4 and 5 afternoons a week, every fall, every spring, it was me and Coach Majors and one of the equipment guys, 3 of us up on that tower. And you know, keep in mind now, I had to cross Johnny Majors Boulevard to get to work every day. When I walked through the lobby of the building, there was Johnny Majors' jersey from 1956 when he should have won the Heisman Trophy. There was his plaque from the College Football Hall of Fame. There was a huge framed portrait of him shaking hands with Bear Bryant after Tennessee beat Alabama in 82. And all the trophies of all the games that he had won as a player and a coach. That's what I saw every day. And then I would go to practice, and there was Coach Majors. I mean, he's the big orange Jesus. And every day, Ryan McGee, how are we doing our history test? Ryan McGee, you still dating that girl from Gallatin? Ryan McGee, what game is your dad refereeing this weekend? I mean, it was like that every single day. And so he's just a class act, man. And his university broke his heart. And that really bothered him. He never got over that. Even after he had reconciled with so many people that were on the staff of the coup d'etat in 92, even though he had reconciled with the people at the university, never reconciled with Philip Fulmer. I talked to him about it a month ago. He's still angry about it. But he's exactly who you thought he was. And my forever image of Coach Majors is I was at Notre Dame in 1991 when Tennessee had the game they called the Miracle of South Bend.
Yes.
And came back and won the game and on a blocked field goal, last play of the game, trailed 3 touchdowns in the first half. But Coach Majors on the sideline at Notre Dame, you know, in the November, in the cold, snow on the ground, and he had that 3-piece tweed suit, and he looked like he was out of an old black and white film, you know, coaching football in the 1930s. He was the coolest. He had every excuse in the world to be a jerk, and never was in the, you know, gosh, in the 30 years I knew him.
You think he's appreciated by the fan base? I mean, when he died, I tweeted something about him and because of what I remembered as a kid. And I mean, I don't get me wrong. It didn't seem like people weren't sad, but I felt like he is your all's Rupp or whatever.
Right, right.
And it didn't feel like that response, certainly from younger fans, but maybe they just don't know.
They don't know. I mean, no, that's just it. They don't know. And I think that's sad because, you know, I'm not saying that Tennessee didn't need to make a head coaching change in 1992. I mean, that's not the debate I'm wanting to have. The debate I'm wanting to have is, and it's not a debate, is that he was – that was handled so poorly. And it was a coup d'etat in the building. I mean, I was there. I was in the building every day. I saw it. And so the way that was handled, and this was pre-internet. This is 1992. And so I remember we were all about that time getting our first email addresses at the school. And we were, as students, we were like, what is this? Electronic mail. I mean, that's but that gives you an idea of the time frame you're talking about. So young people don't know. But I say this all the time. Lane Kiffin, as bizarre as the 1 year Lane Kiffin era was at Tennessee and as many things as went wrong with all that, if Lane Kiffin did nothing else, like the third day on the job, Lane Kiffin and his father, Monty Kiffin, called Johnny Majors, who lived in Knoxville but never came back to campus because he didn't feel welcome, said he didn't feel welcome. They called him and they said, here's a key card. You come in this building anytime you want. And it's been like that ever since. And so if Lane Kiffin did nothing else, I'll always be thankful that he did that, because at least it got Coach back in touch with, you know, the people inside the building. What's been interesting is when Philip Fulmer became athletic director, is watching Coach Majors and Fulmer avoid each other in the building. Like it's like watching a ballet. It's like watching a, yeah, it's like watching a wow. shell game. Yeah.
And that's really a shame. I mean, that's a shame that it was like that. Yeah. I always make the point when I was on Feinbaum before – Feinbaum, folks, I'm banned from that show, not because of Paul. Paul would have me on, but the SEC. The SEC, you can't comment on this because you're on the network, but the SEC can have quite a strong hand. But when I used to host Feinbaum a lot, I would always say, I make this argument, I still stand by it today. Tennessee and Nebraska are the two programs that have fallen the most in the modern era. My argument as to why they have is that all the games are on TV. Back in the day, they weren't. So you had to play at a school like Tennessee or Nebraska to be on television. Now you can do that anywhere. People tend to stay closer to home. So now the best teams are all teams that have a lot of players in their state, and that Tennessee and Nebraska haven't recovered. And I don't think will ever recover on the level they normally do. Now that doesn't mean they won't have a year now and then when things are great. That's my argument. You're a Tennessee fan. Is that argument stupid?
It's not stupid. I mean, and I always I will be very sad here in about 2 weeks, because part of my routine is to go to Omaha, Nebraska, you know, for the College World Series, which is not happening, obviously. But I have always had a connection with the people of Omaha because I love the College World Series, but also because they know I'm a Tennessee guy, and I know they're all Nebraska people, and we all kind of, again, we feel like we're in the same boat. And you think about 1997, those two teams played for a national championship. Mm-hmm. And they stomped Peyton Manning's team. But you think about what those teams were then and what they are now, and you know, working hard to try to get back and going through coaches to try to make it work. And I've thrown Michigan in there too. I've always said those are three programs that have never been as great as they once were. They were all kind of at the peak at the same time, you know, there in the 90s. And, I'm with you. I don't know that. You know, the desire for everyone is to be what Alabama is now. No one's ever been what Alabama is now. No one's ever, I don't think, going to be what Alabama is right now, the run they've had under Saban. But that's what everybody wants to be. What I have tried to tell everyone in Knoxville is you need to focus on having another 10-win season first and then worry about what it is that you're building. And so they're certainly in a much better position than they were a year ago, 2 years ago, 3 years ago. But the consistent, well, listen, man, when I was there, you're talking about the early 90s, and it was 11 win team, a 9-win team, a 10 win team, Heath Shuler, Carl Pickens, Charlie Garner, Dale Carter, Alvin Harper, Heath Shuler. I would just go, you know, just go on Chris Mims, Chuck Smith. I mean, it was just player after player after player after player after player, and it just went on and on and on and on and on.
And you won the championship with T. Martin. The one fact that nobody – it's sort of like you know, everybody thinks that was Peyton Manning's title, but it was T. Martin's. It's sort of like Utah in basketball made the national championship the year after Keith Van Horn left. So everybody always, they lost to Kentucky. Everybody always thinks Van Horn was on that team. Yeah. He wasn't. It's weird.
I always say, Virginia made the Final Four after Ralph Sampson was gone. The year Olden Polynice took Virginia to the Final Four. It wasn't Ralph Sampson. Nice. Yeah. How about that?
All right. Let's switch gears for a second to NASCAR because I'm good friends with the folks at the Kentucky Speedway here in Kentucky, and they always hate when I do my little NASCAR bit because it's the truth. I started picking up NASCAR in the late 90s and then really got into it 99, 2000, of course, when Dale passed. And even for the next few years, I think you could argue from 96 to 2005, NASCAR was as hot as anything in the country. I'm not the only person that would say that.
No question about it.
And that's when I liked it, to be honest with you. I knew everybody. I knew even the terrible drivers. Something changed. I try to pinpoint for me what it is. I don't think the races are necessarily any more boring than they ever were. Maybe to me, it's the personalities, I guess. I think when NASCAR made that transition, there were still dudes who weren't media conscious in a world that all of a sudden the media was on them and they weren't used to it. And it was kind of pleasant and refreshing.
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you think it is that makes it to where it's still popular, but it's not what it was then?
No, it's such a long list. What I always say is that, when Marty Smith and I finally produce and direct our 30 for 30,
yes,
it's going to be the what happened in NASCAR, because it's such a long list of reasons. And, you know, what I always talk about is when the market crashed in 2008,
yes,
when the economy tanked, the one industry that never recovered was motorsports. And you know, what happened was that going all the way back to the early 1970s, NASCAR was on this growth curve that just, you know, a hockey stick. It just kept going up, kept going up, kept going up, and they could do no wrong. And I'll tell you that era you're talking about, I was on the payroll at NASCAR in 2005, 2006, right before the crash. And I worked for NASCAR Productions, think NFL Films with race cars. And I can tell you the sales guys were across the hallway from me, and the phone rang day and night. And those guys never left their office because the phone just rang and rang and rang and rang. And it was Fortune 500 companies. How do I sponsor a team? How do I sponsor a TV show? How do I sponsor a racetrack? You know, I have money to spend. NASCAR is awesome. Where do I spend it? The entire industry created a generation of salespeople who didn't know how to sell. Whether it's whether it's the ticket office, whether, you know, like that era when Kentucky Speedway was built, that late 90s, early 2000s, they're just building racetracks everywhere. The tracks already existed. We're adding 50,000 seats. And so when the market crash happened, you suddenly had a group of salespeople, and that's team owners, it's track owners, it's NASCAR itself, who didn't know how to sell. The phone quit ringing. And I always tell the story that I used to have to shut my door as a script writer to get anything done because those guys were on the phone across the hallway all day. Well, they brought me back on a freelance job in 2009 after the market crash. I sat in my old office and I never had to shut the door because the phones across the hallway weren't ringing. And those guys were just sitting at their desk because they didn't know how to sell. But you think Bristol Motor Speedway knows how to sell tickets? Not a chance.
They never
had to. 10 years ago, it was like Lambeau Field. People were willing their season tickets. You know, when they passed away, it was in their documents. And so they had to completely tear apart their economic model. Then you throw on top of that, I got a 15-year-old daughter. None of her friends care about cars. They don't want the driver's license. They don't really care about having a car. They'll just, you know, they'll get an Uber, right? And so there's a lot of things going on there. And also, and I can't wait to get the tweets when people listen to this, but the Confederate flags don't help. And, you know, Kyle Larson doesn't help. And every time that you get dropping an N-word, you know, on television, that doesn't help. And so every time they seem to get some momentum going, and it's not fair because there's a lot of really great people that are busting their butt to change the image of the sport. But you know, every time they get anything going, there's some sort of setback. And so that's why, honestly, that's why they came back so fast. First to market. They're just trying to get on TV when there's no competition, you know, from any other sport on TV.
And I thought that was actually smart because they're a sport that could do it. And so, so let's use that as an example. So I watched the first race, the Darlington race. Right. I was excited about it because I can't even remember the last time I'd seen a Darlington race.
Yeah.
They even still race there?
Yeah. Labor Day weekend, like they always
say. Okay,
have,
so they still do that, what used to be the Southern 500 or whatever. Right. So because, again, Labor Day weekend, man, I'm watching football, right? So I hadn't seen it. But I watched it, and here's what I thought to myself. This racing is as good as I remember. I mean, like, it's still entertaining. It's still good.
It's great.
But I don't care about these people in a way that I cared about those other people.
Right.
And I sort of wondered if how much of that is that I just don't know them, and maybe if I did, I would care. But, like, or how much of it is they're just not the personalities that there were before. It feels like back in the day, Jeff Gordon was good to have because there was one of him, and now there's 20 of him.
Right, right. Well, and that's the perfect way to put it, because the reality is that this is the most talented and, like, nicest, most dynamic group of young guys that have come along in the 25 years I've been covering the sport. Chase Elliott and Ryan Blaney and the Dillon brothers, and then you throw in the group just ahead of them, the Joey Logano's of the world. This is a crazy talented group of race car drivers. William Byron, who's in, you know, Jeff Gordon's old car now. It's Alex Bowman, who's in Dale Jr.'s old car now. It's a crazy talented group of young guys with ridiculous resumes, and but people just don't know them. And the problem they have is they arrived at a time when the sport was kind of bottoming out when it comes to attendance and television ratings. People just don't know. And you mentioned football. What I have screamed from the mountaintop for so long is, and this goes to this generation, like my daughter's generation, doesn't care anything about it. The races are too long. The race weekends are too long. And the season's too long. Everything's too long. You know, if I'm covering Ohio State, Michigan, then at the absolute longest period of time, I'm leaving Charlotte on a Friday afternoon and I'm back in Charlotte on Saturday night. Sometimes I can leave on Saturday morning and be back on Saturday night or Sunday morning. If I'm covering the whatever it's called 400 at whatever racetrack, it's 4 days. And, you know, there's practice and there's qualifying and it goes on. They're on the track for 3 days. It's just, and the race lasts 3.5-4 hours. If Avengers Endgame lasted 3.5 hours, people would have complained about it. So why are you asking them to sit? And if an NFL game lasts longer than 3 hours, they freak out, a regular Sunday afternoon game. And so there's just you have to adapt. And they have a brand new overhauled schedule that's coming. It's going to be great. But I still think it's a mistake to race so deep into the fall and try to compete with college football on Saturday night and the NFL on Sunday. It's just – I mean, it's a mistake.
But won't there still be, like, okay, so again, go back to when I was watching. Of course, everybody knew Jeff Gordon, Tony Stewart, Dale Earnhardt, Rusty Wallace, et cetera. But I also – Jimmy Spencer was a hell of a personality. Yeah. And everybody hated Robbie Gordon. Yeah. And, like, all 40 guys, I could tell you something about. Yeah. And there were just cool things going on because you knew this dude, hated this dude, and – unless it's Joey Logano or Brad Keselowski or the Bush brothers, it feels like everybody's just, whatever. Like, they're just not, like, no, it just feels like that's not there.
No, it's not. And it's just, and those guys, you know, people always want to blame Jimmy Johnson for all this because he's a boring guy, whatever. That dude's like a superhero. He is so not boring. But the problem is that, you know, his image has been corporatized. And so it's, people don't know how funny he is. People don't know what a wild man he is. People don't know, you know, that, you know, he lives in Aspen and skis the triple black diamond all the time.
Isn't that the problem? He lives in Aspen. Like, I mean, like, I don't want my NASCAR driver to live in Aspen.
Yeah, but Dale Earnhardt was awesome because so Jimmy Johnson grew up in a trailer park. Okay. His mother was a bus driver and his dad was an auto part salesman. And now he lives a few miles away from me in Charlotte, but might as well live 10,000 miles away from me because, you know, he lives on a completely different planet than I do. But he, for whatever reason, is penalized for that success story. But Dale Earnhardt, who was the first NASCAR driver to have multiple private aircraft and the first race car driver to have a 300-foot yacht that he kept in the Bahamas and called Sunday Money. That's cool.
I didn't know he did that.
Yeah. So they all penalized Chase Elliott, Bill Elliott's son, because they say he's a spoiled brat and, you know, grew up in Aspen. And he lived there for half the year as a kid. The first time I met Chase, he was 6 years old. We went out there and did a story for RPM Tonight on ESPN2.
Yeah.
And Chase was snowboarding when he was 6 years old. What he's supposed to not, like, be rich because his dad had a good run? It's just – That's what I say. I think that it's not fair, but it's not this guy's fault. I mean, the companies whose names logos are on their chest have whitewashed who they are.
Even with
what's going on right now with the protests, not enough drivers have been outspoken, and the top drivers have not been outspoken enough, and they're afraid to step out there because they don't want to offend anyone, and they certainly don't want to offend the corporations, you know, whose logos are on their chest. And that's the root of the problem.
Well, let's go back for a second to college sports. And today we're taping this Friday morning, but this afternoon in Lexington, it's scheduled that the UK football team, along with Mark Stoops, is going to march in a protest in Lexington that they've put together, actually. It's interesting. I put that out last night. And I was sort of surprised how little feet pushback there was. I think the vast majority of people were kind of okay with it.
Right.
Even though we're in the South, Kentucky's different than the rest of the South. It's a little, it's a little different.
Yeah.
What's going to happen first football game? Do you think we're going to see protests? And if so, what is the reaction on the college level?
I don't know. I mean, I really don't, because I'm with you. You know, the first team I saw organize and do this was Texas. You know, the majority of the Longhorns marched up to the Capitol building there in Austin. And I kind of was monitoring the reaction to that. And the good news is it wasn't as negative as I thought it was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what's happening now. I mean, we saw the situation at Florida State where the coach says he's had these conversations with these guys, and these guys are going on Twitter going, no, we got group text. And so I think that the players have seized a lot more power, and thankfully so, in very recent seasons. And I think that this is an opportunity for them to finally kind of speak their mind and finally tell everybody how they feel and explain, all right, I appreciate y'all coming to the stadium to watch me on Saturday, but this is who I really am and where I come from. And so I think it's a fantastic trend. And it's been, at the end of the day, the fans of sports are going to side with the athletes first. You know, you and I both have discovered this over the years. Speaking of Kentucky, if a race car driver fails a drug test and you happen to be the guy that writes about Jeremy Mayfield in the middle of all that stuff, even though I'm 100% confident in what I write and I know everything I'm writing, I'm the jerk because the fans of Jeremy Mayfield are going to side with Jeremy Mayfield. And so if the fans of these athletes are going to listen to what they have to say, then I'm all for it. And so, and it terrifies the powers that be, man, because, it's not the inmates running the asylum. It's the kids that are making the money for everyone that are finally, you know, using their platform to speak out.
Well, this is their time. I mean, I say this even before all the George Floyd and the protests, even when they were saying, we're bringing you back to campus before our students, Drew Franklin wrote this on my side, and I agree with him, like, now's the time for players. If they have leverage they've never had before.
Yep.
They don't have a collective union to sort of do it, but I feel like, and maybe I'm wrong, I feel like some individuals are going to use that over the course of this next season. We'll see.
Yeah, no, it's just, these kids are smarter than people know. These kids are, because of the way the recruiting works and because of the socioeconomic background that so many of them have, they are forced to be adults way faster than a lot of us. And so when you hand them a smartphone and give them a platform, or you put a microphone in the front of their face, which happens with these guys all the time, if they have an opportunity now to to use that as a platform, then I think these kids are smart enough to do it. And so now I'm all for it. I've always said, I say this all the time, the biggest difference between being in athletic facilities now versus 10 years ago, or certainly when I was in school a much longer time ago, or when I was a kid and my dad was refereeing football games and I was on sidelines, is there aren't nearly the level of troublemakers that there used to be. There aren't nearly the level of rotten apples that there used to be. The overwhelming majority of these kids are smart. They want to do things the right way. They've worked hard to get where they are. We're talking about success stories coming from nothing and becoming something. That's who they are. And so if they have a chance to use their voice, then I am 100% all for it. The days of caveman football are over. To play the football that they play now, to play the basketball they play now, you have to be smart. You have to. There's no way you can execute this offense or RPGs. You can't do any of that stuff if you're not smart. And so or RPOs, I think that the fact that they have a voice is great, and people should listen to them, whether they agree with them or not. Listen to them.
Well, let's talk about your voice, because you and I had this conversation privately, and I want to have it a little bit more public. We didn't talk very much, which is So I do the NFL pregame show on ESPN, and one of the things that's been interesting to me is how many people, when I go on that platform, bring up my voice.
Right.
Like, they bring up the fact that I have an accent. And I, for many years, have sort of listened, okay, who out there that does sports has a real accent, like a thick accent?
Right.
Marty Smith is obviously the one everybody knows, but he initially started, like you, NASCAR and college football, right?
Marty and I met 20-plus years ago, like at the South Boston Speedway. Yeah. That's his background.
So NASCAR and college football, those are the things where it has seemed like it was okay to sound like we do.
Right.
Do you – really, though, besides you two, and I'm not on your level, but besides you two – and that, like, they're just not a lot of people to find that do that. Do you think it's a hindrance? Do you think it's just like something that's just random? What do you think? And has it affected you?
It was certainly a hindrance to start off with. I mean, you know, the first half of my career, I was a TV producer. I was a feature producer. I mentioned working on RPM Tonight. When I went to ESPN right out of college and walked into the building in Bristol, Connecticut, and this was 20-plus years ago. And at the time, and ESPN was much smaller then, the campus was much smaller then, the only Southerners in the company in the mid-90s, it was me, it was Reese Davis, it was Stu Scott, who at the time was claiming to be from Brooklyn. He wasn't all in on
being he wasn't North Carolina guy.
No, I still get a hard time about it. And when he talked to me, he sounded way different than he did when he was in the hallway. and we had one editor, a video editor, a woman from Greenville, South Carolina. That was it. I mean, in the entire company. And so when I first started ESPN, it was all Northeastern corridor, you know, prep school, a lot of Ivy Leaguers and political science majors, you know, that just love the Mets. So they wouldn't work at ESPN. And so I got treated as a foreign exchange student. Like, people would talk louder and slower to me. And when I moved up there, so I'm right out of college. I move up there. I think the Southern accent's going to play. Like, I think I'm going to meet girls. And what I realized was that if you were a female with a Southern accent, that was cute.
That was good, yeah.
If you were a male with a Southern accent, there was something wrong with you, you know. And so I had one date, I think, in a couple of years. That's going to be my official excuse, was that it was my accent. But I chose to be a producer and a writer because I had been told, even when I was in school in the Southeast, you can't be on TV or be on the radio and sound like you sound. You have to sound like Tom Brokaw, you know, neutral Midwestern accent. So what's been interesting is I've got this weird career path, but I end up on the radio, right? I end up on TV a little bit. And prior to the Southeastern Conference Network, you know, it was only just regular ESPN radio and sports and whatever. And what Marty and I both get all the time is people think the accent is fake. Like, we've got it for some bosses, which is tone it down just a little bit. I'm like, tone it down? You should have heard me in 1992, right? And so, or you should hear Dirty or the Nine-Fingered Bandit or Stank or these guys I went to high school with, you know, in Raleigh and in Traverse Rest, South Carolina. You think my accent's thick? And so, yeah, I think there is a little bit of a hurdle, but I don't think it's like it used to be. You know, it's a little bit of a novelty to people, and they do think we're faking it a little bit. But, you know, I don't get that complaint on the SEC Network. It's interesting.
SEC Network's different.
Yeah, SEC Network, they don't seem to care.
Well, it's interesting. I don't think, like, mine's not as sort of thick as yours, but it comes out, like, mine's more hillbilly. Like, it's like the eyes and the, knot and lot and sight and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
That, but I do, it there will be words that I will say that then the people will just be like, what did you just say? Like, like they, and I do think it does seem like there are, it's more accepted, but still to this day, Ryan, I mean, let's be honest, name me one. Like they don't, you know, they still don't put those folks on the air. And you know, and that, by the way, that's not just in sports. You know, you mentioned I like politics. There is not a Southern political voice that isn't some kind of far right winger that they ever put on television either. Like, it's just like there's a whole group of people. They just say, we don't think you're worthy outside of your region.
So I had that conversation with Judy Woodruff. And Judy Woodruff, who, you know, one of the great, I mean, pioneer, groundbreaker, you know, female news anchors. And a Duke. I think she's a Duke alum. In fact, when my brother graduated Wake Forest, and he graduated Randolph Childress. Judy Woodruff, who was, I think, at CNN at the time, she was my brother's graduation speaker. And she opened her speech by saying, "Where's Randolph Childress? I was sent here by Duke to make sure you were graduating and getting out of here."
That's a good line.
Pretty good. Yeah. But the one time I sat with her, I talked with her about that because she's Southern. And we talked about, you know, there's still a little lilt in her voice, but she absolutely worked her training out. Reese Davis is from Muscle Shoals, Alabama.
Well, you wouldn't know it. No, you wouldn't know Reese Davis was.
But when Reese came along, and Reese started ESPN around the same time I did in the mid-90s, and when Reese came along, and Reese has been a dear friend of mine forever. Reese just wrote the foreword for the book I'm writing with my father about college football officiating. And Reese had to scrub some of his dialect, a big part of his dialect, because if you wanted to be on TV, certainly if you wanted to come to the Northeast and be on ESPN, that's how you did it. If he came along now, I think he'd be cut more slack. But certainly in the mid-90s, it was still a lot of old, you know, a lot of old school minds were in charge. But like, even now, though, I mean, I love ESPN. I'm a lifer. I'm going to work there until the day they tell me I have to go away, which I hope is when I retire. I left once. I'm never going to leave again, you know, on my own. And but my bosses now are a lot of my bosses that were there then. And a lot of them never own cars. So I still had to explain to them, like, why, you know, motorsports is a big deal, you know? So it's
interesting.
It's cultural. But I don't understand half of what they eat just because of where I grew up, right? So it's just, I love that part of the job. Even if they give me a hard time about it.
Going to Bristol, it is interesting. It's a different world. Like, it's its own insulated community. I mean, I was fascinated when I was a kid. So I drive all over the country. Like, I take, like, long road trips every year.
I do the same thing,
So I've driven to every state and twice in my life before I did anything for ESPN, I just drove to Bristol to drive by the campus. It's much less impressive than you would think. Like if you were just, it's impressive, but like if you just
now though, I mean, it's when I first worked there again in the mid-90s and ESPN2 had just started, I mean, it just was a handful of office buildings.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have even known what it was except for one little sign and a satellite dish. Now though, I don't know when's the last time you were there. Now you come in through this grand.
Oh, yeah. I'm just saying,
feels
like
it, yeah.
If you're not able to go inside, it's just like
you should, it's not office like buildings.
It's office buildings.
Right.
But once you're there, it is amazing the sort of it has its own culture. You know, I'm there on weekends and I'm usually there on Sundays. And during the NFL games on Sundays, there's a room where it's almost like if you were a kid, you kind of dream it's like this. Like all their NFL talent goes and sits in a room together and watches all the games, and they talk to each other.
They eat and yell. Yeah,
and it's awesome. And they make fun of each other, and it is the most awesome thing. Like I love going to Bristol just to do that. Yeah. Do you ever still pinch yourself sometimes and go, "Hey, I'm getting to do this stuff. It's crazy."
Every day I do, but particularly when I'm on campus. When I'm on campus up there, and part of it too is nostalgic for me, just because I went there right out of college, and you know, but it's But when you, I tell people all the time, the This Is Sports Center ad campaign is only exaggerated a little bit. Like, you know, I remember when I first started going back to Bristol 10 years ago, we used to do a nightly show called NASCAR Now. And I would go up one or two Mondays a month. We'd do a roundtable discussion about what had happened in the race on Sunday. And I would stay in this little residence inn there in Southington, Connecticut, which is the basically the but really where ESPN is. And you go downstairs to get the free breakfast. And this is, you know, this is 10 years ago, but you'd be sitting there and Dave Winfield is sitting here and Magic Johnson is sitting here and Rusty Wallace is over here and Rick Sutcliffe, and they're all just drinking coffee and reading the paper, you know, in the lobby of the Southington Residence Inn. And I'm like, I would have paid money to stand in line and get these guys autographs, and have in a lot of cases. And so it is really like that. And it particularly like when big games are going on, I've never been in Vegas for like the Final Four or the Super Bowl or whatever, but I have been at ESPN when the big game is going on, and it is the coolest feeling in the world. And so, yeah,
there was
as a TV nerd, it's just the greatest.
There was a Saturday where I was there, so I would do the show on Sundays, but I'd have to come up on Saturday so I could do my UK shows from there.
Right.
And I was there, and there was a rumor going around that Kanye West was in the building.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I don't think he was, but there was a rumor that he was. And I was watching all these big-time stars, like, geeking out and wondering if they could go and figure out what part of the building Kanye West was in.
Yeah.
And it was just sort of funny because it was like you would think, I don't know, it was the moment I realized these are just human beings too. Like, you sit there and you see these people, but there are stars bigger than the people you see. And when they hear that Kanye's in the building, they feel the same way.
Dale Earnhardt Jr., who is probably the most famous person on my phone. But Dale Earnhardt Jr. tells the story all the time about he and Danica Patrick were asked by Jay-Z to be in a video. And it was the two of them, like, in crazy cars driving through the hills of Monaco. And meanwhile, Jay-Z's doing whatever. And so they shoot the video. And that night, Dale Jr. and Danica went to dinner with Jay-Z, who brought his wife. And so Dale Jr. says, man, he goes, you know, I'm kind of famous. I go, yeah. And he goes, but there's a difference between being famous and then being famous.
Yes, I'm sure.
And he was talking about, you know, when Jay-Z and Beyonce came into the restaurant, they literally like opened the roof and showed the stars like in this restaurant, and they came in and sat down and they closed the roof. It was like, but that's when you know you're a star. So, So it's funny. Jeff Gordon told me about Tom Cruise. Jeff Gordon's like, listen, man, there was a time I was pretty famous. He goes, but then you spend an hour with Tom Cruise, like at dinner, and he goes, and you realize, no, that's famous. There's a whole other level. So, yeah, no, but I'm telling you, being on campus in Bristol is the coolest thing. And now it's something to look at. You used to just be like an office park that happened to have TV cameras in it. Now, you know, if you ever get the chance to go to Walt Disney Studios in Burbank, there's just a feeling when you walk on that campus. It's unbelievable. And that's how Bristol feels now. That's how it should feel. It should be like, you know, intimidating the heads of state when they come to Washington, right?
I've never been more nervous in my life than walking in to do the very first show there. So I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yep.
Let's finish with this. Give everybody your prediction. You know better than certainly me and than almost anyone listening. When does college football start? Do they play a full season? What does it look like?
I think that they will play close to a full season. I'm not ready to commit to a full season yet, and I think it just starts a little later maybe than people want. I'm not talking about November, but I do think that they might have to take a pause. You know, but I'll say this too. This goes back to what we talked about at the beginning of this conversation. I am also factoring in reason there and not emotion. And not, you know, the guy whose name is over the athletic facility saying, no, I want to see a game this weekend. And so I think they will play football in September. And whether it's the middle of September, late September, or Labor Day weekend, I do not believe there's going to be a full capacity crowd. I think there might not be any crowds at all in the beginning. But I have learned covering NASCAR races with no fans, and we're about to learn covering the NBA playoffs with no fans. All due respect to the fans, I don't think they matter at this point. The
games really? Matter. Now, see, I disagree with that.
They do.
NASCAR's different because you can't hear the fans on TV. But I watched wrestling.
In UFC, I get that. But I'm just telling you right now, man, if it's watch a game at home and it's on television and it's quiet, whatever. This part has astounded me since the start of all this, which is if I come to you and I say you can still have Kentucky-Louisville, it's just going to be a lot quieter.
You take it.
Don't get it at all.
Yeah, you take
it. And I've been shocked at how many people have been like, oh, I don't want to see games if there's no crowd. Well, then
– yeah, that's nonsense.
You know, it's just nonsense. But I hope, and I want to make sure I'm clear on this because people seem to think that I want nothing to work. I want more than anything else in the world that it's a full slate of week one games with tailgaters and with crowd in the stands and with College Game Day with 10,000 people behind it and SEC Nation with a slightly smaller crowd behind it. I want all of that to happen. But I don't think it's going to look exactly like that when the season starts.
I got one thing I want to ask you off the air, so don't click off yet. But for everybody else, thank you guys very much for listening. We'll be back next week. Next week, I think I've got country music radio guy Bobby Bones.
Bobby Paul Bones? Feinbaum.
Yeah, Bobby Bones become a buddy of mine. I know that's – wow. Do you know him at all?
No, I don't know him at all, but he's you know him, who's a Dancing with the Stars champion.
Yes.
And I know Kenny Mayne, who's the worst dancer in the history of Dancing with the Stars.
No, one dude – Tom DeLay, the former, he was worse than Kenny Mayne. But Bobby Bones, Paul Feinbaum, and Myron Metcalf next week. Thank you guys very much.